This is our last in the series that we are doing this week on books out of the festival scrolls in the Old Testament. And today we're going to be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you have your Bibles handy, we will be looking at it eventually. At first, though, I'd like to spend a little time doing some introduction. It's a longer book, so we will not read through it, as we did almost with Song of Solomon. And it's not a narrative like Esther, where a person can attempt to tell the story and get into the story. It's a different kind of book. It's more like a philosopher's musings on a rainy day, or on a long rainy night. Esther, if I can review what the three books do in a sense in contrast in theme, really celebrates the deliverance of God's people from a terrible catastrophe. And it raises to me the intriguing question of the problem of justice. In other words, once you have established justice between you and a person, and you've settled the score, is that all there is to life? And the New Testament, and even the Old Testament, wants to say, I think, that somehow God is greater than just justice, but he's also interested in grace. And mercy reestablishes relationship, whereas justice simply terminates matters. And yet Esther makes a very strong statement for the need for justice, and really emphasizes the survival of God's people. So that was Esther, and we may want to come back to any one of these themes if we have a little time at the close of our session today. Song of Solomon also raises an interesting question, the problem of our sexuality. But it does it only indirectly, and it in fact is celebrating the gift of our sexuality as men and women, and particularly in our relationships, in our marriages. But it does indirectly raise certain questions at the personal level, given our fundamental self-centeredness and all of the problems of human self-deception, and if you want to put it in one big biblical word, sin. The question comes up when you read Song of Solomon, how is such love ever to be achieved? How is such love to be sustained in marriage? And what about all of us who are single, who aren't married yet, who are divorced? Boy, that kind of a book really hurts. At a social level, I think the Song of Solomon is an interesting statement in the Old Testament. We've heard a lot of talk about the deep-seated male dominance in the Old Testament. And Song of Solomon seems like a fresh breath of air. Look at this, men and women equal. In fact, the woman is almost the initiator, it seems, of the relationship of the man and the woman. At least she surely has equal voice, and she expresses her desires. And it's very interesting that the usual theme of the woman's purpose and role as being adjunct to the male, and there primarily for the sake of childbearing, is really remarkably dramatically liberated. She is an equal to the male, and she has as much voice in the interchange, the mutuality, as the man. And she's not there for childbearing. I don't think, unless it's very implicit, there's any word that the purpose of all of this is so that that man can have his offspring. And yet, saying all of that, still the song is confined very much to the matrimonial situation. The whole question of the woman in society, the kinds of issues that were raised by Susan 2 days ago in her New Testament presentation on John, when we looked at the woman at the well of Samaria, those issues simply are on the periphery. And hence, I think Song of Solomon also wants to point us to the New Testament, at least that's its widest context for Christians in a number of different ways, both as a wider community, as a wider range of equality and mutual ministry to one another, and as Christ being a source of love and relationship which transcends and maybe undergirds the family, the husband-wife relation. That just suggests some of the ways in which these two books point ahead to the New Testament. I like to use the picture of throwing a bridge or an arch. They point ahead. Well, what about Ecclesiastes? Now we're ready to take a look at that. Ecclesiastes, I think, deals with the question of meaning, in a sense, the meaning of life, the purpose of life. And if you are at all familiar with a book, you'll be struck by its deep-seated pessimism. All of the commentators somehow come to terms with that or deal with that problem. But before we look at that, I want to again back up and do a little bit of introducing to indicate how much on the periphery Ecclesiastes is. As you can guess, they debated, the rabbis, whether Ecclesiastes really should be in Scripture. The debate was not so much whether they should let it in. Evidently, it was in Scripture, but they debated whether it should stay in. So we can ask ourselves, too, what is Ecclesiastes doing in the Bible? And can it also be part of our life story? I'm sure you all have some thoughts on this. So, as I say, I'd like to put this into its widest context of the Old Testament. And a book that I found very useful here, a recent book on Old Testament introduction, is a book by the name of Hans Walter Wolf, the Americans would say, Wolf, the Germans. W-O-L-F, put out by Fortress, The Old Testament, A Guide to Its Writings. He does something very interesting for those of you who've been in Old Testament studies at all. In the past, there have been great efforts to find unity in the whole Old Testament. And one of the great themes was the covenant theme. And I think Eichrodt wrote a major study dealing with that, how that unifies the whole Old Testament. Other people have suggested that what brings the whole Old Testament together is salvation history. The Germans have a great word for it. You have to kind of sneeze when you say it. Heilsgeschichte. Hachu. Okay. But the problem with both of these treatments of theme in the Old Testament, and there are a number of others, is that it is difficult to bring the wisdom literature into these themes. There's not much about Heilsgeschichte and not much about covenant in Old Testament. Well, people like Zimmerli in Germany and Wolf, this other writer that I've referred to, have come back now to the most central thing of all, and that is that the significance of the Old Testament stands and falls with what it says about God. At the very heart of the Torah, which is, you might say, at the very base of the whole Old Testament scripture, is Yahweh, the name of Yahweh. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And at the very end of Deuteronomy, we're told that Joshua did all that Moses commanded the Lord. And some of us are aware that this is perhaps getting to the very tail end of putting the Torah together. So if we want to look at some of the earliest elements in the Torah, there's perhaps the song of Miriam when the children of Israel got through the Dead Sea. And she says, or sings, "Sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea." So it is the Lord who is at the beginning of Israel's life and carries it all the way through. And then Wolf, in his understanding of the Old Testament, organizes it beautifully. He says, gradually Israel comes to see that God was the God who said his word and did his work in their past. And so much of the Old Testament remembers and celebrates the past. At the same time, they began to see that God was also in control of the future. And we like to say, too, you know, he is in control of our future. And so the prophets are nothing less than God speaking into the future, about the future, in fact, bringing the future into the present. So the prophets ultimately are going to say what's coming is not just the future, but God himself. Often in a kind of frightening way, because God comes in judgment. And yet at the same time, in a hopeful way, that ultimately he comes with deliverance or salvation or with hope. Okay, and then the third category would be God speaking in the present or helping us in the present. And here's where the wisdom literature comes in. And it's interesting that when the ancient Greek translators reorganized the Hebrew canon, which was organized a little bit differently, they had the history books in the beginning and they put the prophetic books at the end. That's the way our canon is. And most of the later books, the so-called writings, are put in the middle, like Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. So here in this wisdom literature, we have writings that deal with living life before God or with God or under God in the present. And much of these writings are very positive and affirmative. At the same time, they deal with life problems, and ultimately they raise lots of difficult questions and raise also the question of God himself. Now, we're going to look in a little while at some of the motifs in some of the other wisdom literature, but I thought, having this kind of background, we might move pretty quickly now into Ecclesiastes itself. When people read it, they usually jump right in and say, well, let's see what this is all about. And the first thing that is striking about it, if you want to open up the book now, is its title, Ecclesiastes or the Preacher. Some of the Bibles have the Hebrew word in, and this has become a popular word now so that it's almost well-known in English. It's called Koheleth or Kohelet. And that comes from the Hebrew word, which means to assemble, and he's like the person who calls an assembly and then teaches the people who are the assemblers. That's why a number of translators have called him the preacher. The Greek word for Kohelet is Ecclesiastes. Now, that's how he introduces himself. The words of the preacher. And yet, he describes himself as the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. Consequently, for centuries, tradition had it that Solomon wrote this book. And he describes himself, the speaker, as Solomon, but nearly everyone has agreed now that Solomon did not write the book. Luther, for example, way back at his time, said it's impossible that Solomon wrote this book and must come from some later scribe. Since then, the students who study the language are deeply convinced that there's so many late words here that it must come from a very late time. But it does raise a question, why does he describe himself somewhat as Solomon? So you see already some very interesting, tantalizing thoughts come up. Traditionally, what students learn when they first learn about this is that Song of Solomon describes a Solomon in his youth. Proverbs gives us Solomon in his maturity, where he knows about the wise conduct of life, and when he gets to Ecclesiastes, it's Solomon in his old age. He looks back and says, well, now this is the way it really is. Pessimistic and very questioning about the value of anything in life. Well, that's perhaps an initial way to deal with it, and I've suggested that we need to probe a little further. Generally, people have had two kinds of theories. One is it comes from a pessimistic time in Israel's history, and it reflects their era. And there may be something to that. Israel is a small people. Perhaps they're back in the ancient land, but they have trouble building the temple. They have trouble with their enemies. They have trouble with their government. There are no more prophets. There are problems. Things ain't what they used to be. Or some people have suggested it reflects the mind of the author, that he is in a deep mood. And you even pick this up on the traditional description of Solomon in old age, looking back and being a little wiser, a little older. Is that adequate? Is that adequate for its being in the Bible? Many people have asked the question very seriously. Okay, so that's just a word about the author, and that already begins to get us into the matter a little bit. What we want to do now is look at the way in which some of the people have taken a look at this book and have suggested what it's all about. One of the most pervasive understandings is that it's a deeply pessimistic book. One writer, Wolfe, in fact, says, this book, like no other book in the Old Testament and the New Testament, speaks to the 20th century mind. Sartre, Camus, all of these writers said, now here's a book in the Old Testament we understand. There's a deep nihilism about life reflected there. Let's see if it's there. One Old Testament scholar takes chapter 1, verse 2, and verse 14, and then way at the end, chapter 12, verse 8, as the key to the entire book. And what is that key? Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes, a generation comes, the earth remains forever. 6. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. You even get tired uttering how weary it is to live. You get weary uttering weariness. What has been is what will be. It's already happened, it's all going to happen again. And what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. People even forget what has gone on in the past. How many of us will be remembered 3 generations from now? And then in verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. I have to tell you here that that's one phrase I remember from my father, who has passed away some time ago. He used to say, with a twinkle in his eye, he enjoyed reading Schopenhauer too, that German pessimistic philosopher. Alles ist ein Haschen nach Wind. Everything is a biting after wind. The word, the Hebrew word for vanity, hebel, comes from the word for wind, for breath. And I love the picture, a striving after wind, of a little kitten running around in the room trying to catch its tail. Have you ever seen that? Playful kitten? That's a marvelous picture for this wind, this circuity, the futility of life. Okay, now, the rest of the book then, after the theme has been established, simply supports this theme. Some writers have even suggested, oh yes, there are a few positive notes here and there, but obviously they were later added by a later editor. And if you want to get the force of the book in its deep truth, here's what it's all about. Now, maybe you want to argue with that, and I do too, honestly, and I'll come to that in a minute, but this is how the book has been interpreted. And people who view it this way, like R.Y.B. Scott, a well-known, important current commentator, argues the only reason the book is in the book is that way at the end it says God's judgment will come. Just don't forget that. But even that is a kind of a grim closing note. What are some of the other ways in which people have approached it? A commentary that we were often directed to in our youth was by a man by the name of P.E. Kretzmann. It was a very conservative commentary, and he said, yes, indeed, it shows the vanity of life, but the purpose of all of this is, quote, to lead us to the contemplation of heavenly things. In other words, you're miserable in bed. Well, the reason why you're miserable in bed is so that you can look up to heaven. Someday you will be with God. And just think, the misery here even makes you more anticipating of the life that is to come. Now, he had some verses to support that. Let's look at the one I think that I can find, or maybe two. Chapter 3, verse 12 would be one. Maybe 11 already. He has made everything beautiful. This is God in its time, but he has put eternity into man's mind. Of course, then he goes on and adds, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. But in any case, that little verse, he has put eternity into man's mind. If you take that out of its context, you say, aha, you see it's all pointing in that direction. Or let's look at a verse way at the end of that chapter. Let's see. Verse 20. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward or the spirit of the beast goes down to earth? So here there's a suggestion that man should be pointed to his heavenly goal. And yet I think most people will say there's very slim pickings here on a strong statement about heaven. It's kind of snatching at it, and we really are looking elsewhere in Scripture to support that point. The question is that the purpose of this book? To make us look at the pessimism of life so that we will look forward to life after death? My suspicion is it probably is not. Now, someone else has suggested, aha, there is a different theme here, and that is, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And the reason for looking at the pessimism is to say, listen, folks, that's the way life is, so you better enjoy it while you have it. And there are some interesting passages in that vein. Some of the most striking are the following, chapter 9, verse 7. And then also 10, verse 19. Let's look at 9:7. You can back up a little bit. Look at verse 4, for example, a kind of a grim proverb there. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Some of us saw a great movie of Lake, what was it, Otasha? Itasha in South Africa. And there the image of nature with its eternal cycle and the question of whether it's better to be alive or dead comes up again and again, I think, if you think about your own life. But at any rate, verse 7, go eat your bread with enjoyment, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Interestingly enough, you even get God's approval for it. Well, doesn't that open a can of worms?
Or beer.
Or beer and peanuts. What about 10:17? Let's see what you do with that. Oh, I don't mean 17. That really is an interesting counter word. 10:19 is the one I was looking at. An astonishing verse. Indeed. Question mark. Or look at chapter 11, verse 9. Very interesting. Please don't read the last line, though. Chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart, in the sight of your eyes. Period. We won't read the next verse. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Well, let me summarize a little bit now what I've tried to do. I've tried to suggest a method of reading Ecclesiastes that maybe a lot of us might be tempted into as we browse around in this book. And that's what I'd call the Jack Horner approach. Right? Little Jack Horner sat in a corner. No, that's not right. Is it? What did he, how does that go on? Eating his something, his Christmas pies. He put in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy am I. What's so bad about recognizing that his mom put in these nice good plums and pulling them out? You only get little bits. Anyone else say what's bad about that?
The rest of it doesn't taste so good.
Then. He's only pulling out the goodies, right? I remember when we were kids, we had to eat the whole sandwich. We couldn't just pull out the sausage. Now, Mom is here, and she'll vouch for that. See, she wasn't listening, fortunately.
I just wondered if your Christmas pie was supposed to have plums in
it. Well, I think he must have had prophetic vision. I believe the British have plum pudding, don't they, for Christmas?
Yeah.
Well, but the point is, now to get it back to hermeneutical interpretive principles, is our temptation is to pick out those words which we're interested in and disregard the rest, right? Let's pick out the verses that say, eat, drink, and be merry. And they say, I'm glad I found that in the Bible and God even approves it. Right? Or let's pick out the verses which say there's a deep pessimism here. Or let's pick out the verse which says God puts eternity in a man's mind. Well, what I've tried to suggest, we've got to look at the thing a little bit more closely and ask, how does this book work anyway? And what is its purpose? Okay, let me try to put a thesis down, which a number of people have suggested now, which I think is excellent. It's perhaps been best developed by a teacher in Germany who's actually Swiss. His name is Zimmerli, Heinrich Zimmerli, and unfortunately it not is popularized yet, but I hope it gradually spills over into our study guides. His suggestion is, as many people have already implied, we have to see this book in the context of the wisdom literature, especially of Proverbs. And this book is attempting to make us look critically at a superficial understanding of wisdom literature. And furthermore, it's inviting us to live a wise life, examining our disappointed expectations with life. How does it do that? It literally takes us on a mental trip with the reader. With the writer. He is thinking things through. And he wants us to think along with him. Okay, now that changes the whole way in which we understand, let's say, the first 14 verses. R.W.B. Scott, LaRue, and others, people, and perhaps we at first say, aha, that's the theme of the book, deep pessimism. Zimmerli wants us to say, maybe it's not the theme of the book, but it's the stance of the thinker. It's the stance of us, looking at life critically, doing some reflecting. Okay, and what are we supposed to reflect about? Well, here I have to say a little bit about some of the basic teachings in wisdom literature. The most basic notion, I think, in wisdom literature, in terms of its practicality, is that an action has its consequence. And perhaps we should look at just a few examples of this. It's really worth it, also to give you a flavor of Proverbs. So if you'll take a break now, let's take a look at some of the verses in Proverbs. Chapter 11 gives us a couple of interesting instances. It's just a little bit behind Ecclesiastes. Chapter 11, verse 12. I think that's what I want. He who belittles his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. Here we have a contrasting verse. And suggests that you have two different kinds of behavior. It doesn't really say so much about the consequences of the behavior, but for the moment at least it suggests two different kinds of behavior. The consequences would come out more clearly, for example, in verse 14. Where there is no guidance, a people falls, but in abundance of counselors, there is safety. Or let's take a look at verse 16. A gracious woman gets honor, violent men get riches. Interesting contrast. By the way, the woman here gets much higher praise than the violent men. There are many different forms. Sometimes they're artistic. I want you to take a moment to look at an interesting one in 26:11, paging ahead a bit. This comes back in the New Testament in one of the very late books. Artistic in a rather vivid way, if you'll forgive this selection. Like a dog that returns to its vomit, so is a fool that repeats his folly. Or look at the verse before it, and you see a whole series of the same sort. Let's page back to chapter 23, verse 31 to 35. There's much interest in suggesting moderation in the use of intoxicating beverages. Usually the advice is, as given in verse 30, those do not tarry long over wine, or those who go to try mixed wine. In other words, mixed drinks. And usually the consequences are spelled out in considerable detail. In other words, the proverb writer does not just say, take my advice, but he wants us to look at the consequences. And there's a basic rule in life. He is saying that a certain action will lead to certain consequences. And he gives you quite a list of consequences here. Do not look at the wine when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things. Your mind utter perverse things. You will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea. And so on. Well, it's delightful, and you see how neatly it teaches by suggesting the consequences of human action. Okay, the fundamental notion about Proverbs is that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And Proverbs suggests that out of the fear of God will come the good life. If we fail to fear God and act foolishly, we're going to pay the consequences. Okay, now let's take a look back. I hope that whets your appetites for Proverbs, but I would like you to come back to Ecclesiastes a moment. We'll look just at a few verses which show ways in which this understanding of life is undercut by the writer. In other words, he says if you take these principles without looking at them critically, you will be in for real disappointment. For example, in verse 13 of chapter 1, where is this love of life and seeing God as the source of fullness of life in a verse like that? Right? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the sons of men to be busy with. Or Ecclesiastes suggests that the wise man will gradually acquire wisdom and knowledge. But look at chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, verse 17. You can begin with verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the works of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. But though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. See again, a critical look at simply taking wisdom literature and saying, aha, that's the simple answer to all of life. He's saying it's not that easy. And I think all of us may nod inside and say, you know, there's a lot of truth to this. I hate to admit it. But some people say, I'm glad it's here. I'm glad someone is this honest. Okay, let's look at one or two other examples I've jotted down. We're near chapter 7. Let's look at chapter 7, verse 15 to 16. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. There is a wicked man who prolongs his life in evil doing. And then if you'll skip over, I think, to chapter 8, verse 14, very similar in tone. There is a vanity which takes place on earth, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and that there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. That's turning the whole notion on its head of the whole doctrine of just rewards or of just retribution. Well, where are we then? What happens? Life is chaos. Here the writer is thinking about it. He's reflecting about it. He's stepping back and he says, I've seen all this. The book of Job is very similar, except Job is living it. And his friends are telling him, Job, you must have sinned, because obviously a man who's suffering like you wouldn't be suffering like you if he hasn't done wrong. So his friends are good theologians. They're taking wisdom literature, the doctrine of just rewards. They're looking at a friend who's in trouble, and they're saying, dear friend, you know why you're in trouble? You must have done something wrong, and God is correcting you. He's chastising you. He's trying to set you right. Job says, no, it isn't so. And his tremendous, passionate no is what this writer is saying in cool, quiet, calm, philosophical reflection. Now, I want to just pause a moment. There are many points of application, of course, in the book of Job or in a statement like this, and I don't want to get there too quickly, but at least I might suggest it here, that when we are dealing with people in trouble and they talk this way, we're tempted to say to try to set them right away and say, no, you shouldn't talk that way. And then we may come on like Job's friends. So there is time for saying, you know, this is the way life sometimes is this way. In any case, the writer does this, and he's deeply honest about how he feels about life, and his deep pessimism breaks through all over the place. I think we might look at one or two verses which catch that. Take a look at chapter 8, for example, verse 7, after he's saying about all the troubles of life, he says, for man does not know what is to be, and who can tell him how it will be. So that's one verse, I think, which suggests that deep pessimism. And you might look back at the beginning of the book, chapter 2, verse 20, the very first sentence of 20, or first part of 20. Here he's tried everything. He's tried riches, he's tried building, he's tried wisdom, he's tried pleasure. And the result of all of this, he says, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair. So he takes us right down, you know, to the very depth and says that's how indeed he has felt. Okay, if we feel that's bad, we might say it even gets worse before it gets better. One thing I think that is so disturbing about the book is that God seems so far away and his actions seem to be so arbitrary. We've already got little hints of that. I'd like to look at one or two other lines which suggest that. For example, let's take a look at chapter 8, verse 17. Oh, that's one we looked at too. Then I saw all the work of God that man cannot find out what it means. Yes, we've looked at that one. So let's take a look at 9:11 following. Again, I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, or riches to the intelligent, favor to the men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. The implication, I think, here is that God, who controls life towards good ends, suddenly is coming out as a God who is deeply pessimistic, who is not involved with human events, but chance rules all. I think that's what's so disturbing about that sentence and how we may feel at times. Or another word about where is God in all of this would be chapter 11, verse 5. As you do not know how the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. There's a deep kind of agnosticism here. The consequence of this might be, and this might be good for all of us who talk too much, spelled out in chapter 5, verse 2. Do not be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. Saying it to myself, don't talk too much and too glibly about God. You may not know what you're talking about. A further theme that is developed in the book, as we've heard many times, is that death is the common end of all. We might look at one or two verses which suggest that. Chapter 3, I think, is interesting in this regard. Especially verses 18 and then 19. I said in my heart with regard to the sons of men that God is testing them to show them that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts are the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over their beasts, for all is vanity. So again and again, he suggests the central and final fact of life seems to be death. And what makes it more disturbing for him is that very often a man who works hard all his life finds out that death takes his wealth away from him, and he leaves it to someone else who is not even going to appreciate what it is that he's left to him. For instance, if he does not have his own offspring, or if he has children who are foolish and are wasteful with his goods. Let's look at one last theme that he looks at to get through all the pessimism. He looks at man's depravity. In other words, it isn't just that man has a limited life and that life is repetitious and that man does not know about much about God and God does not seem to be guiding life in a neat pattern, but even more than that, man runs into just plain human cussedness in life.
And that's very deep. And it brings us, in a way, to many of the themes of our social concern here at Holden, and the injustice in the world, and the poverty, and what can we do about that? Chapter 4, verse 1 and following, I think, is a very strong passage in this regard. You could find others. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are practiced under the sun. Behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living, who are still alive. And better than both is he who has not yet been, and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Now, having laid out all of these negative thoughts, where do we go? I've kind of skipped the positive ones on purpose because I think that they suggest a kind of flying on the beam as people to do today who fly airplanes and fly when they fly with their instruments. There's a kind of, I don't even know if it's called a radar beam. Does anyone know the term for it, flying on the beam? There's a kind of beam that you fly which I think if you're flying on the beam, you don't hear any noise. But the moment you get off the beam, there's a signal that you're either too far to the left, too far to the right, too high, or too low. So flying on the beam is that central moment. And this book in a sense, takes us into all sorts of different directions to help us, I believe, find a central motif. And how might we put that? Well, let's take a look at some verses which may suggest it, and I'm going to ask you to pitch in comments here as we look at some of them. For example, let's begin with verse chapter 7, verse 15, which followed chapter 7, verse 16, which followed the 15 that we read before. Be not righteous overmuch, and do not make yourself overwise, for why should you destroy yourself? Okay, there are a number of other passages which suggest what I'd call the theme of living within limits. Living within the limits of our time, living within the limits of our other commitments, not trying to be overachievers. What's another theme that he suggests? It's the theme of enjoying life. We've seen it in a number of places, and I think we might look at chapter 6, verse 1, which gives us both some positives and some negatives. There's an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy upon man, a man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, honor, so that he lacks nothing, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. That is vanity. It is a sore affliction. And then he continues this, if a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days and his years are many, but he does not enjoy life's goods, also has no burial, I say, an untimely birth is better off than he. Okay, so having said words like that, then I think we might point out some of the other words which suggest the force of enjoying life properly. One passage was already in chapter 11, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart, in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things God will bring you into judgment. When I read it the first time, we chuckled because it seemed to be merely an ironic undercutting. But perhaps he is saying we should enjoy life, but also within a certain context. And he leaves it for us to deal with that. If you want to page back to chapter 9 now, I'd like to follow up on the theme of enjoyment a little bit more here with verse 9. Chapter 9, verse 9, enjoy life with the wife with whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun. Verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. I think with all your might, you might translate that. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol. In other words, you might be saying, make the most of the time. And while there is a lot of foolishness in life, he still wants to say wisdom is better than foolishness. And that's another theme that we might look at. I think a nice example here is a little story that he gives, and it is undercut, and yet it comes out with an ultimate flying on the beam again. Verse 13 of that chapter. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came up against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. Aha, there it is. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heeded. One other theme I think that he suggests is know the time. That's one way in which to live wisely. Know your own limits. Know the fact that judgment is coming. Know the fact that you may not be remembered, but live wisely anyway. And know the time. Let's take a look at chapter 3 here, which is perhaps one of the best-known sections in a beautiful poem, which is often read and I think often enjoyed. There's a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, and so on, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep silent, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, a time for peace. I don't read the last verse because there the writer is once again pulling the rug out. Just when we think we have it all in a nice orderly system, a time for everything, he says, what gain has the worker from his toil? Okay. So having said that, I'd like to come back now to chapter 2, verse 24, and put this all into, let's say, a most fundamental context. And the context would be, on the one hand, enjoying life, and on the other hand, fearing God. It seems to me, for me personally at least, that's the secret of the beam on which he flies. Chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and heaping, only to give it to one who pleases God. Now it's interesting that he says here, this also is vanity in the striving after wind. And I'm not sure what you make of that. Perhaps what you make of it is, that's easy to say, sir, but it's awfully hard to do. So let's just watch it, them nice words right here in Koinonia, but let's see if we can go out and really enjoy life and fear God as we enjoy life and enjoy life as we seek to fear him. Well, perhaps that might be a point of concluding, and I'd like to throw it open for your comments, response, questions on this book or on any of the other two that we've looked at. And then way at the end, I'd like to look at one New Testament passage which I think sort of catches the arc which this book seems to me also to throw into the future. Because the only thing this book sees in the future is the coming judgment of God. But it surely raises the interesting question of, well, is this the be-all and the end-all of God's wisdom, namely, only what man knows? You notice his refrain is, I said to myself, I looked at life, I tested life. He's a real pragmatist, and he tells us what man can find out in his own mind. And he's saying, I can't find out the mind of God. Is that the end of human wisdom? Or is there more to wisdom? You know, and are there not some fascinating New Testament passages which sort of catch this arch in the New Testament again? So that might be the widest context. Maybe you're already thinking of those passages. Maybe you want to talk about this book and some of the questions it raises for you. Or maybe some verses in it that you love and are your favorite. So I want to throw the ball to you. And don't be like those who worry about and seek after all these things. What are our expectations? Your Heavenly Father knows you have need of them. Seek first his kingdom. Brother, what an order. And all these things will be added. And then he comes back. Therefore, don't be anxious about tomorrow. Tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Let the day's own trouble be sufficient unto the day. There's an interesting, sobering final note, which is just like Ecclesiastes. Yeah.
Isn't that great? Okay, thank you for being here.